Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by four, count them, four fascinating guests. These are the most people we've had in this studio since we opened, and we're going to have a great conversation about global business and Arizona, our engagements across multiple borders and regions. Joining me is Melissa Sanderson, Vice President for International Affairs with Freeport McMoRan and co-chair of the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. Welcome back, Mel.
Thank you very much, Adrian.
It's nice to see you again. You were here in July. We had a great conversation. We're going to take that in some different directions today. Also with us are Jeffrey Garza Walker and Joshua Rodriguez from Cressa. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And then rounding out the mix of our panel today, we have Kevin Hull, Vice President at BMO Harris Bank. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Adrian.
Now, what I love about these kind of conversations is that there are topics that are so interesting and so nuanced and so complex that we could probably spend many hours talking about them, but they touch businesses here in the Valley in sometimes unexpected and interesting ways. So I'm always looking to find those angles that somebody who may be either deeply interested in international affairs or just mildly curious about some of the ways this might affect them and affect all of us here in the Valley, and they can get some new insights and some new perspectives. Mel Sanderson, let's start with you. I'd love for you to just give us a brief overview of your work and how your current role gives you a window into what's happening in the world as well as here in the Valley.
Sure, it's a pleasure. I would say initially that the thing to know is that I'm also the chair of the Arizona District Export Council, and that is a public-private partnership working with the Department of Commerce to encourage exports, to bring new-to-export companies into that market, and also to encourage foreign direct investment into the United States. And all of those activities result in increased job creation for Americans. So that's a very key point in looking at why exports matter, why trade agreements matter. You take, for instance, what has been the effect of the NAFTA agreement just for Arizona? Let's not even talk about the entire United States. So for Arizona, over a 20-year period of time, what NAFTA enabled was a protected environment with defined parameters, boosting business confidence, and leading to the establishment of an extensive network of cross-border supply chain relationships. It has also contributed to a decline in the overall rate until recently of illegal immigration, because as jobs were created in Mexico, more Mexican citizens stayed home to work rather than trying to enter the United States to find viable employment. So in a nutshell, I think that those are some of the great advantages of an international trade environment that is underpinned by global institutions and interconnected trade agreements.
Now, Mel, you also have a 21-year career as a Foreign Service Officer in the Department of State and have worked all over the world. And that was really also the heyday of free trade agreements. The Commerce Department within embassies were working on negotiating these deals, both bilaterally as well as with the region. And I know you have some interesting opinions on the way in which these free trade agreements have been very beneficial to the United States and hopefully as well to our partners. But why do these kind of agreements matter?
I do have to correct you on one small point.
Please do.
The Department of Commerce does not negotiate those agreements. That falls within the purview of the Department of State.
Well, there you go.
Not that I personally ever negotiated any trade agreements, but just as an institutional point of information. Well, they matter because if you look at the world today, you find a rise in nationalist sentiment, and that's accompanied by a rise in protectionist activity. When you have trade agreements in place, those substantially work to restrain those kinds of negative forces. because a country which has signed on to either a multilateral or a bilateral trade agreement accepts that the terms of that trade agreement will be paramount in dealing with companies from the signatory members. So hypothetically, let's say Nation X passes a law saying, okay, mining companies, you need to hand over a greater percentage of participation in your project to our government. That happens, and it's happening right now in the world. But in countries where we do not have those kinds of overarching trade agreements, where we have those in place, companies are protected from that sort of transitory political and economic activity. So it provides that sense of surety, and it also puts the full force of the United States government behind you to protect you. Whereas if there's no trade agreement, you don't necessarily get that same level of protection.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and also heightens the urgency with which we deal with negotiating agreements like the USMCA, which we'll circle back and talk about in some detail, because it's the one of the moment that we need to get worked out here. Let's move to Jeffrey Garza-Walker and Joshua Rodriguez. Why don't you give us an introduction to CRESA and to your work? What's your role and what do you do? Who do you serve?
So we're with CRESA, which is the world's largest firm that represents occupiers of space. And so what that means is that if it's a business that is utilizing real estate for a business purpose, we represent them only. We don't represent landlords. So we'd like to say that we have a conflict-free solution, because we're always on your side as a business owner. We're never on the other side. Joshua and I, in particular, we go by the moniker Team LATAM. So we were brought on to CRESA to service the portfolio clients in the United States that have requirements in Mexico and Latin America, primarily industrial, with some corporate offices, but 99% of what we do is industrial. And so right now we're working on 30 requirements throughout Mexico. We've got requirements in Panama, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Bogota, Colombia. So all throughout. And what we do is we help those clients find the spaces that they need to be able to operate and be efficient in what they're doing. And the reason we've been successful is because we're a conduit. So a lot of what's happened before in commercial real estate is it was a handoff. So if you had a requirement here, they would hand it off to the broker down there. Joshua and I actually are the people that carry the ball all the way down there. And so what that allows the corporations to do, and why they're really liking it, is because they now can get a little bit more control back, because a lot of their comments are, it's like the Wild Wild West down there. You know, they're basically relying on them to tell them what's going on, and they really don't have a person that can look at it from both sides. So that's what Joshua and I provide. And we've been extremely successful representing companies like Anixter, 3M, Scientific Games. So those are companies that we're representing on their portfolio requirements. And then also as a flip side, we've been able to help businesses that are down there that are coming here. And so we're working with companies like Sigma Alimentos, who owns Bar S Foods in the United States. We're working with Rema, who's the largest plastic manufacturer down there, and now they have operations here. So those are the things that we work on and help to facilitate for those companies that are transacting down there and transacting back here.
You know, I'm fascinated by the fact that it's easy to spout off a lot of ideology and rhetoric about pretty much anything. And one thing I know about human beings is we've got opinions about everything, and we're pretty sure that ours are the most important ones, et cetera, et cetera. It's really when you get into the weeds with these kind of contracts, these kind of deals, the complexity of negotiating a particular property or parcel or something, where you start to really learn that there's a lot of gray. And that obviously your goal is to make as much of that clear and distinct, so that your clients, the tenants, are best served in these relationships. But I'm just reminded of a conversation we've had in this studio with a zoning attorney. And the reality of when you're trying to bring together the municipality and the community that's going to be affected by a particular project, and the investor and the developer, you're really now talking about the kind of micro politics, if you will. And that's where it gets really interesting and really matters. Joshua Rodriguez, you're the younger of the duo here. I'm curious to know a little bit about
you. Wow, that was a zinger.
Well, by 6 months or so, as I can tell.
Good recovery.
I'm curious to know a little bit about why you wanted to be involved in this. Talk to me a little bit about what piqued your interest. You received a master's in real estate development from Arizona State University, bachelor's in business management. So you've been in the world of business for a while. Why was this particular role something that appealed to you?
Absolutely. So this has been a top priority for Jeffrey and myself to be able to execute and fulfill these requirements for a market that is just underserved. So we are proud and have the ability to not only speak the language for the market in Latin America, but we know the customs and the regulations that involve facilitating any type of transaction or advisory for our clients in those markets. So not only do we do Mexico and Latin America, we also service the at market transactions, but we pride ourselves that we have that niche in that market. And we, just like Jeffrey mentioned, we are the conduit where we take the ball from beginning to the end, from the start of the line to the finish line.
Now, I've interviewed before other people from your industry, and it doesn't seem to me like anybody starts out thinking, you know what I really want to be when I grow up is a commercial real estate expert. How did you find your way specifically to this realm of professional practice?
So I got to give kudos to my father. He's been working in residential real estate for the last 26 years. So I was introduced into the industry first starting out with residential and got my license at 18. And did 1 year of residential, then morphed and met Jeffrey Garza Walker with the company that he launched, or the commercial team that he launched with DPR Realty. So our trajectory commenced there, and we've been in lockstep with each other, moving on from company to company until we finally reached the company that enables us to facilitate and execute that strategy that we both have to facilitate globally.
Yeah. And Jeffrey, let's talk about that for a minute. You were in the inaugural year graduate of the Master's in Real Estate Development program. So, you know, without throwing shade about the age differences, you have seen a few more years of this industry. What is that specific commitment that Joshua just spoke to? And why is this role now something that really fulfills you? Personally.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to put some more shade on that, I was in the inaugural year in 2006, 2007 of the MRED program at ASU. And then Joshua graduated 10 years later. So just sort of, as if you think about that time frame, but for me, this has been a passion. After I graduated from college, I actually went to work for the International YMCA, and I lived in Mexico for a year, starting up YMCAs all over Mexico. And then they shipped me to Spain for 6 months, and I did that for 6 months. And oh, by the way, it was 1992, which was the Olympics, and I got to go to Barcelona and see the original dream team. And so that just really was a foundation of, I knew that I wanted to do things globally. And so when I came back, found my way down to Arizona through a series of, you know, different jobs that I had done with the YMCA, and then decided to get into the corporate world. But as I jumped into real estate, I really knew that that was the vehicle that I wanted to utilize. And I felt that, you know, being able to have that opportunity, I wanted to be with a firm like Cressa that had a global reach. And so, you know, like anything, you try out a couple firms, you think that, you know, this could get me there. But what you begin to realize is, if they don't have the true capability, it's like anything. You know, we're passionate about servicing our clients. I'm passionate about what I do. So if I tell you, hey, I can take care of you and I can get you the best thing down there that's possible, I want to make sure that if I tell you that, that I can deliver on that. And with Cressa, we have the ability to do that. And so for Joshua and I, we both have roots. We're both Hispanic. You know, my family, my grandparents came, my grandfather's from Monterrey. He came across the border with my grandmother from Chihuahua. He got his citizenship by fighting World War II. And Joshua has a similar story. You know, his dad's from Puerto Rico, his mom's from Mexico. So, you know, it's ingrained in our culture as well, but it allows us to fulfill both sides of our culture and both sides of our business priorities, which really, you know, at the end of the day, how much fun's that? You actually get to go and do what both your passions are.
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin Hull, you're with BMO Harris Bank, and you have your own international background and experience. Can you give us an overview of your work and how you got into that?
Sure, absolutely. So BMO Harris, so we're part of the Bank of Montreal. We were Canada's first bank, formed in 1817. We have 600 offices here in the States and 900 in Canada, and then trade finance and capital market support in various other cities throughout the world. So in college, I've always had an interest in the international side of things. And coming to work at BMO back in the 90s gave me some exposure to the international market. So I worked with companies that were primarily based in the U.S., but had operations, you know, in other parts of the world. So there was different support mechanisms that they needed. Also companies that were either importing or exporting that required various different support services too. And we can elaborate on those a little bit later. But very early on in my career, I had the chance to work with a company whose headquarters was based in Germany, had manufacturing operations on four of the seven continents, and their U.S. operations was in my hometown in Chicago. So at a young banking age, relatively young, I guess, had the chance to get exposed to the international manufacturing and understand all of the logistics and challenges that were involved in that, and took a keen interest on that. And since that time, it's always been kind of a focus of mine to work with companies who have similar types of situations and then help them, you know, get through those situations and get to the next level.
And when did you move to the Valley and what precipitated that?
2012. And what precipitated it was one day I opened my garage door back in Schaumburg, Illinois, and the snowdrift was up to my chest. And went back in the house and said, honey, I'm done. After 40 some years of living in the snow, and my wife has family out here in Arizona, so we've been visiting here for so often. And had always said, boy, if there's ever an opportunity, I sure would like to relocate. And my wife and I are both natives of Chicago, so it was a kind of a big decision for us. But back in 2010, BMO acquired M&I Bank, and the full conversion happened in 2012. So that's when I decided to relocate from BMO Chicago and come out to Arizona.
Yeah. You know, my kids who are 5 and 7 are just now having, well, I guess we started maybe 18 months ago, their first experience of banking, which of course so much has changed. I'm 46 and from when I was a kid, but I still remember as a kid going with my parents and getting my little passbook and kind of having that first initiation. Here's the banker and here's how your money works and here's how you give them your money. In fact, we were just rewatching the original Mary Poppins the other day, and that whole thing about, you know, two tuppence, put them in the bank and you can turn it into imperialism and other things. It's a very dated concept. How do you begin to explain commercial banking? Now I'm being very self-interested here because I got a 5 and 7 year old that listen to this show from time to time. What's the difference between the kind of banking they're just now starting to understand and the kind of work that you oversee and do?
That's a good segue, because I actually volunteer for Junior Achievement and I teach a JA class for my son. He's our youngest. He's 9. And that's our topic. So we had to, it's a 5-session topic, and it's about entrepreneurship. And you start, you know, talking about resources and region, and then you work through the different processes through the 5 sessions. But one of them is financing. And we talk about, you know, the example that we did was a hot dog stand. Another one was ice cream stand, and went through the analysis of, okay, and these are fourth graders, mind you. And they were like with us, you know, through the whole step there. You know, what are you going to buy to sell? What are you going to pay your workers? What are you going to pay for advertising? And where do you get that money? And then that's where the banking side came in. A few kids said, you know, my mom or my dad. But I said, okay, we're talking bigger numbers here. So we got to go to the bank. So so you have that exercise. And how do you, you know, finance or obtain funding? And then how do you, you know, manage through your process to sell a product at a price high enough to, A, repay the bank, pay your suppliers, and then pay yourself a little bit. So I know that's kind of a simple way of doing it, but, you know, the kids grasped onto it very well and had a lot of fun with it. So roll it ahead to real world, and it's a little bit more complex, right? You have different currency exchanges. So some clients have to buy in that host country currency. That creates a set of risk, right? So if the currency moves the wrong way, they could get hurt on that. So we sit down and put solutions together to help minimize that risk and mitigate as best as we can. So protect them on the exchange rate. That way they can protect their margins. If you're exporting product, you need to get paid. We work with them on international letters of credit and making sure that once the order is fulfilled, there's a mechanism for payment to come back in. It works the other way too, where we have a client who wants to export a product. And the client, their customer, this one was in Turkey. And it was the first time the two businesses were working together. The Turkish company agreed to do a full prepayment of the order. It was the first time they were doing business, but they needed some assurances that order was going to go through. So we stepped in and did what's called a payment guarantee. So we issued a letter of credit to the Turkish company saying that if that product is not shipped, then you can draw on that letter of credit and get your money back. So obviously our client was very creditworthy, so we're able to provide that kind of letter of credit guarantee. But that's some of the nuances from the international side. You may not always encounter that on the domestic side, but it is a lot more frequent on the international side.
Well, I'm struck by the fact that for so many businesses, the explosion of access to technology and markets and communication infrastructure through developments that have taken place on top of the internet in the last 15 years has really changed the game. And you now have everyone from, you know, solopreneurs and home-based businesses who are developing significant e-commerce operations, selling something that they either make or source themselves, and whether they're selling it on Amazon or they're selling it through Shopify, using Instagram swipe up ads to drive awareness for consumer facing products. In the B2B world as well, so much has changed. And I'm struck by the fact that there are established large multinational companies that have kind of been navigating this for a while due to imperialism. We go back to the Dutch East Indies Company if you want to do the history lesson on this. But today's environment, there are many companies that may be thinking about going global. And it really would be, as in the case of that Turkish example, doing a transaction for the first time. There really is a bit of a frontier, a Wild West, except it's not limited to the West, as most things aren't, except for our presumptions of superiority, but that's a different story. In any case, how do you begin to talk with companies about the benefits of going global, the challenges they might incur when it's something new, not something that they've been doing for 30 or 40 years?
Great. Good question. We've had those conversations with companies. And, you know, from the benefits side, diversity and diversification of a client base is key. It makes for a stronger company. It can protect you in case of, you know, if one of your clients is acquired or has an issue. If you have a diversified client base, you can kind of withstand some challenges a little bit better. It also makes you a little bit more valuable company in the eyes of shareholders or investors and those who are looking to acquire a company. So diversified a client base helps out a lot. Diversifying geography. Right now, U.S. economy is probably growing better than most of the other economies. But what if that changes? And what if Europe starts growing faster, or Asia or South America? Wouldn't it be nice to have relationships and customer relationships in those areas as well? That way, if we slow down and they pick up, you hedge yourself a little bit. So it helps from a geography standpoint. It helps from a client diversification standpoint. So to me, that's one of the biggest benefits. You have multiple sources of revenue then, and that makes you more valuable in the eyes of, again, of investors and shareholders. So one of the clients I work with here in the Valley, we met them about 5 or 6 years ago, and they were about $12 million a year in revenue. So a decent sized company, but nearly all domestic, right? And then they have a product that was appealing to some companies that are in Canada and as well as in Europe. So you roll the clock ahead 5 years, they now do $35-38 million in revenue. They've expanded from 40,000 square feet to 80,000 square feet in the West Valley. They went from 7,500 employees to almost 200 full-paying jobs with good benefits, or good-paying jobs with full benefits, I should say. So that's a win-win-win across the board. Company wins because they have now new clients throughout the world. Grew their company, grew the revenue. Brought on more employees. So that's a win for the community. The community now has an employer there that is bringing on several new employees and with good wages and good benefits. And then we win because it's a new client and someone we work with and to continue to help grow.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things when we talk about global or certainly international issues, we're not just talking about the faraway places. In many cases, we are talking about our nearest and dearest neighbors. There's unique dynamics here in Arizona with regard to our trade relationship with Mexico, by far our largest trading partner, and the many different types of companies, some based in the U.S., some based in Mexico, some based other places, trading both, that are actively engaged in a daily practice of international business. Again, this is far from the rhetoric and the nightly news spin and things of that nature. There's people who are every day concerned with moving products and expertise back and forth across this border. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Joshua and Jeffrey, certainly with your focus on Latin American relations, Mexico plays a role in that. What are your thoughts on the current state of trade and business more generally between Arizona and Mexico?
Well, we think that it's actually at an all-time high. I mean, as many people, you know, their comment is, well, has immigration slowed you down? And we say no. If anything, what's really even spurred more activity is the tariffs with China. So what we've seen is a lot of companies have pivoted and actually either moved operations from China to Thailand or pivoted to Mexico. And they're finding the nice thing down in Mexico is that they've developed a tech force. So before it used to be primarily manufacturing. Now there's a tech force down there that companies are tapping into. So that's a thing that's become really something that a lot of companies are willing to go down and utilize that workforce. And then manufacturing is still at a great price down there, but it's with the supply chain logistics, it's easier than ever to move product back and forth. And in fact, you know, Arizona is going to be the first airport, Mesa Gateway, where we're actually going to have a customs official from Mexico and from the United States on premise that you'll be able to fly your goods here, have them get through customs and distribute those throughout the United States. So these are things that are game changers. This is allowing companies to have much more quicker velocity, allowing them to be able to move those products, to get them going back and forth. And so we really see it right now as this is one of the best times we've ever seen. But there are nuances. I mean, it was interesting on the banking side, as you're down there and you're actually doing transactions, you begin to realize one of the negotiating points that we have is, okay, if you're going to pay us, we want to be paid in US dollars. But we also want to make sure that we put in there that if there's a change in the currency valuation, we want that adjusted so that we don't lose out based on that. So those are things that you don't even think about that become issues. And then there again, there's a lot of, I would say before there was, and there still is, fraud down there. So Mexico has very stringent laws on you have to have a constitutive act, which basically is very onerous on saying that you are who you say you are, so that when you conduct business, you have the right to conduct business. And if you don't have that, legitimate businesses, they won't do business with you. So there's a lot of things in place that are facilitating business and allowing it to transact and happen. And we see it really as a time where the gap's just shrinking, and it's becoming that world where, you know, they are our largest trading partner because it's so easy to facilitate and do business together.
Yeah, and certainly not just the airports, but the border crossings, the development of infrastructure around all of this is something that has been happening. And there's a lot of exciting new innovation that I think we should all be paying attention to in Nogales and Yuma and other places.
Let me jump in on that.
Please.
So one of the things that's huge is as of last year, Mexico deregulated all of their utilities. So before, the government always controlled all of the utilities. So now you have a company actually from France that is building out infrastructure for electrical, for plants. That was not allowed before. So to your point, there's some big changes that have come with the Mexican government that have deregulated a lot of those things. And that's encouraging foreign investment, which is there again, creating much more of a sustainable market, you know, to facilitate that growth.
Let's talk about foreign investment in the United States and also with Latin American companies seeking to establish presence here, not just customers, but actual operations. What are they looking for? What are some of the unique dynamics and what do they need? How do you support them in that?
Great. Well, we have two great examples for you. So I'm glad you teed that up for me so I can hit it down the fairway. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's one of the exciting things that we've been able to see. So one of our main purposes with Cresa was to come in and help companies here that are transacting down there. But then the byproduct for us was to find companies down there that want to facilitate and transact here. So we're working with two companies that have two different reasons. So one of them I mentioned, well, I actually mentioned both of them, but Reyma, who is the largest plastics manufacturer in all of Mexico and Latin America. So if you eat anything on plastic, forks, spoons, plates, they make it. Okay. Well, they wanted to have a presence in the United States because they felt that they could garner more business by having a presence here, but they really didn't need to manufacture here. That doesn't make sense to come and open up a manufacturing plant.
Right.
So they wanted to open up a distribution plant. So they opened up one here for 176,000 square feet. They're only using about 20,000 of that right now. Well, guess who one of their customers were they were able to gain that told them that had you not been located in the United States, we probably wouldn't have given you the business, even though you're a Mexican company. It was Shamrock Farms. So all of Shamrock Farms, all of their paper, everything comes from Rayma. So there's a great success story of by having a presence in the United States, they were able to win more business. The second one I've mentioned already is Sigma Alimentos, who is the largest meat food provider in all of Mexico and Latin America. So you probably haven't heard of them, but you will. So they wanted to have a presence in the United States. So just like a lot of companies do, they said, let's go acquire Bar S Foods, who is a national brand. Many of you have probably eaten a Bar S hot dog. You know, they're in a lot of supermarkets, but they bought the Bar S brand. And so now they're here and they're rebranding that so that they can launch. And so we're helping them with the requirement in Chicago. They're redoing things to that. And then Sigma also bought another company in Europe. So they have Sigma Europe and their main location is out of Madrid, Spain. So there's, there again, example of a large company coming here and making an acquisition and then needing help to fine tune that so that it fits the overall portfolio.
In on the economic balance sheet of all of these very specific examples is the question of our trade agreements, of tariffs, of things that are getting a lot of coverage in the news. Mel, can you give us a bit of an introduction to this? Why are the tariffs important? What's the effect that they're having? Are we talking about the right things when it comes to these issues and dealing with perceived trade imbalances? Can you begin? This is a very complex question. Can you give us an overview, help us begin to navigate the issue?
Yeah, I'll certainly try. I may not succeed, but I'll try. Starting with the part of your question that says, what are the effects of the tariffs? That is the one that is hardest to quantify because many of the tariffs are industry specific. For instance, we just had an announcement about tariffs against steel and aluminum coming from, you know, Brazil and a couple of other countries. Well, so clearly that carries the potential for a very positive knock-on effect for steel and aluminum manufacturers in the United States. Then that's a good story. Tariffs in China, because of the size of the Chinese economy and because of the size of our trade relationship and because of the depth of our trade relationship, those tariffs are a great example of why you can't really answer that question clearly. You can certainly make the argument that those tariffs have had an effect of bringing the Chinese to the table to talk about some of their IP practices, because China consistently for 20 years has had laws in place that, in simple terms, requires technology companies to hand over a lot of their fundamental technology and knowledge to Chinese competitors. Clearly unfair. There's no reciprocal requirement in the United States that would provide the same demand to Chinese companies. So you can definitely make an argument that tariffs are one, you know, legitimate response. But then you get into areas like, well, what about agriculture? Tariffs on agriculture are very rarely positive because they tend to negatively affect both sides of that equation. So that's just to say that industry by industry, the answer could be, yay, it's great. Or the answer could be, oh my God, what is the government thinking of leveling tariffs in this regard? On the global scale, economists are increasingly worried about a global recession as a direct knock-on effect of the tariffs and a direct knock-on effect of what could be construed as a tax on a system of global free trade agreements. And the consequences of that, as I remarked earlier, can be unleashing protectionism, can be attacking fundamental institutions like the World Trade Organization that has played a profoundly important role over 30 years in facilitating trade and resolving trade disputes before they reach the level where governments can begin imposing tariffs. And incidentally, rules on whether tariffs are a appropriate response to a very complex economic situation.
Well, to that point, I mean, Abraham Maslow said years ago that if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. Begs the question, if the only tool is tariffs, well, anyway, it's not the only tool. Are tariffs the only way? Are they the best way? What are other mechanisms available to deal with these perceived imbalances?
Well, as an economist, I will tell you that when I was trained, I was told that tariffs are the tool of last resort. That is what you go to when negotiation has failed, when reasonable discussion has failed, when the losses to an industry are reaching unacceptable proportions, then you go to the tariff solution. But frankly, trade agreements are actually an alternative solution and a far more preferable one. The problem that trade agreements face today is, in order to negotiate a trade agreement, all parties to the negotiation have to share one fundamental belief, that trade agreements are good. And let's not confuse that with trade agreements mean everybody wins, because there's no such thing. Any time that you sit down to negotiate, whether it's with your bank over interest rates, or whether it's worth with the owner of a building over rental rates, there's going to be one party that perceives that it didn't do as well as it believed it should have done, i.e., a perception of loss. That's inevitable. So you have to have a global situation in which nations believe that on balance, trade agreements deliver more benefit than pain. And what we're facing in the world today is many countries are shifting away from that belief. They are shifting back to what we saw 20, 30 years ago, that's in shorthand terms called the win-lose phenomenon. We can't have a deal because you will win and I will lose, and therefore I'm not even going to negotiate with you, because I would be a fool to negotiate when I believe going in that my pain will be greater than my gain. And that's what led initially to the change in approach to the so-called win-win negotiation, where the objective fundamentally is to minimize pain on both sides of the table rather than maximize gain. It's a very important philosophical distinction. And sadly, that's what has changed in the world today.
Yeah, I'm just struck as you're talking. I'm not an economist, but a social scientist who focuses on the people side of things, who spent a lot of time in conflict areas. And the exact same scenario is why we see the persistence over many years, and not to reduce those complex conflicts, but the idea that if I even negotiate, I've already lost. And the zero-sum mentality, certainly pervasive. And I think this is something we all collectively as human beings have to start growing up about, which is, look, there's fundamentally, you either think we live in a world of abundance or a world of scarcity. And that fundamental belief, which is rarely an actual belief in the sense of it's something you think about, it's more like in the background, and what you think is a function of that basic orientation to the world, begins to change everything. It changes the way you conduct yourself in business, the way you relate to people who don't look like you or talk like you, the way, you know, in other words, reducing a very complex set of issues to a bumper sticker. You know, is fear driving this, or is the goal of working together to make everyone better driving this? Kevin Hull, I'm certain that tariffs are an issue that has affected your clients. How does that look from the banking side of things?
Yeah, it definitely has affected some of our clients. And, you know, we'll use companies that import from China as an example. We have several that are involved in that. And the immediate impact, it does affect pricing and affects their margins. The tariffs are a real cost. And not all the times you can pass on those costs to your clients. Or if you can, it's usually gradually. So an example at kind of sheds light on that. So if you're buying $1 million of product from a exporter based in China, and you have a 25% tariff, that's $250,000 you have to pay right now to get your product, you know, off the port, right? So that $250,000 is not going to go to invest in property, plant, or people. That is where you have the negative effect on the economy. It's no coincidence that when the tariffs were instituted, that immediately we went from a 2.5-3% GDP down to what, 1.5 to 2. So I'm not an economist, but as a closet economist, I think there's obviously a direct relationship there between those two. So what do companies do? They have a couple of different choices. They can work to pass on those price increases. Very difficult, especially if they're dealing with, you know, large corporate retailers, because a lot of those, the pricing is set, you know, well in advance. Or if they can pass along that pricing, you know, it's usually done gradually over time. So they'll eventually recoup that $250,000, but it's going to take some time. They can work on the currency side of things. Is there some relief if they bought in US dollars, if they bought in host country dollars? Can they help protect their margin that way? The one thing we did notice is the valuation between China currency and US dollar. There was enough of a delta there where our clients were able to negotiate some price relief from their suppliers, because the supplier then made it up on the exchange rate side. And then, you know, the other side of things is, and we're seeing this from more and more now from clients, they are looking to source product from other locations. We are seeing more activity in Mexico now than what I've probably seen in the last 10 years. Others are staying in Asia, but they're going to Cambodia, they're going to Vietnam. Some is coming back to the States, not a lot, but some. Gets back to what I mentioned earlier about diversification. When you want to diversify your client base, you have to diversify your supply base. And I think some clients got probably a little bit more concentrated in working with China exclusively, probably because there wasn't that many alternatives, or because, you know, best price and best delivery, or what have you. But now it's just taking a step back and saying, we really need to take a look at this supply chain, and can we diversify that and minimize our risk a little bit? We have a couple of clients that have looked at that and said, you know what, we're going to stay here in China. We have a great relationship with our suppliers. We're working on the pricing. If I pack up and go to Vietnam, or if I pack up and go to Cambodia, there's already trade deficits there. Are we going to go through this again? And that brings up a good point, you know. So some have chose to go ahead and hunker down. Others have decided to go ahead and make that move and find alternative suppliers. Again, they see some strength in diversification.
If I could just jump in there, because there's two important points that I think bear emphasizing. It's not as easy to shift as people think. Let's just take China to Vietnam. The very small, relatively speaking, Vietnamese economy has an absorption limit, number one. It doesn't have the physical infrastructure in place. It doesn't have a labor force in place, quantitatively speaking, or in many instances in specialized industries, qualitatively speaking. So it's virtually impossible for some firms to be able to simply pick up sticks and move elsewhere. And the other point that I think bears emphasis is, if tariffs are imposed on the belief that it will force U.S. companies to reshore to the U.S., they shouldn't be imposed at all.
Mm. Yeah. And one thing we noticed, and to add on to that commentary, in looking at Vietnam, there's the opportunity there, but they don't have the infrastructure in place to the same level that China has. So it affects your logistics. It affects your ability to get product to port and get it out on time. With our clients, there cannot be a delay in getting this product. So that on the surface, there's an opportunity, but when they take a closer look, it's not worth the risk to take on some potential logistic challenges. Others have assessed that risk, and maybe they're in a little bit different industry than the other client who said no, but they've been able to assess those conditions, and it's been a pass for them, and they've been able to work it out. So, but every case is unique, and that's what makes it even more challenging, right?
Now, a very kind of simpleton kind of a question. My understanding of diversification as a way to mitigate risk is it requires the existence of negative correlations, that something over here will not necessarily drive something over there. They'll move in an inverse way to each other. As the world economies become more entangled, is diversification at the level that it used to be becoming harder to find, given at some level we're in the same boat, or is that not a correct premise?
What we've seen, it's been a shift. The supply chain is global, and I'll give you an example. The issue with the EU, with the Boeing case, right? So the potential for tariffs that go on certain products that are being shipped to us out of Europe or out of the EU. We have a client who's 100% concentrated. All of their product comes out of the EU. They could be adversely impacted. They worked with their suppliers who have operations across the world. So you're right, in a way, it may move from one area to another. So negative there, positive over here, but it's the same company. So from that company's side, it's a wash, right? So they were able to mitigate the exposure by shifting production from EU to a different area of the world. And hopefully that, you know, for EU's sake, hopefully that production will go back there, you know, and not harm them. So, but that, because those tariffs were significant, it would have, you know, evaporated the margins on these products. So that's one key when you're working with suppliers, is what is their diversification policy? Do they have the ability to shift production to other areas then? And not just tariffs. What if there's natural disaster? Look what happened in the auto industry when the tsunami effect in Japan. You know, that was a horrible situation. And then you tack onto that how it affected the economy. The auto industry struggled from that because a lot of parts were produced in that area of the world, could not get produced, and it slowed that industry down. So, you know, other natural disasters, whether it's earthquake or, you know, weather storms or whatever.
A similar. I don't remember the details, but a similar thing hit technology industry with the drastic reduction in capacity for hard drive production due to flooding in Southeast Asia a number of years ago.
Semiconductors.
Yep. Mel.
Before we move on, I think it's also important to note that the tariffs are not monolithic, by which I mean the Department of Commerce has an exemption procedure. So, you know, they take a look. They'll listen to industry associations. They even, from time to time, listen to individual companies in order to evaluate the impact. And yes, it can be a lengthy and legalistically complicated procedure, but you can apply for exceptional status. And I think that's important also for people to know that it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be trapped and be eradicated.
It's worth the investment of time. We've had a few that have done that and were successful. And if you can save yourself 10, 15, 25% in tariff, it's worth that investment of time.
Jeffrey Garza-Walker, Joshua Rodriguez, as we look at the commercial real estate industry, what are some of the emerging trends? What are you seeing on the horizon in this global perspective?
So when you say trends, do you mean what do we see happening as we go forward into the next? Can you believe it? We're leaving the 19 and heading to the 20s. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that one. I think you just spoke about it. I mean, it's just such, I tell people it's a shrinking world. We're getting so more connected and close. I mean, really, that's one of the things we're involved with the Global Chamber. We were awarded the top international commercial real estate firm by them. But the reason we joined the Global Chamber was because it's a network of other individuals that we can reach out to and be able to facilitate whatever we need in those countries. And I can do it off my iPhone. We, you know, we do video calls off our iPhone. We go into our conference room and put them up on the screen. I mean, we've got the WhatsApp. I mean, it's amazing at the amount of connectivity. And I tell people, if you look at year over year, like people think about, oh, you know, we're the retinal scan and all that stuff's people, it's coming. I think in the next 3 to 5 years, you won't have a wallet. You know, everything's going to be on here, and eventually this is all going to be implanted in your body. And I think people think that that's science fiction, but when you go back to the global scale, it's so much easier to transact and conduct business that people are figuring out, how do we do that? How do we minimize our risk? How do we take advantage of things that you can do at a lower cost basis that allows me to grow my company and offset that risk and create more of a profit margin? And those questions are being answered on a daily basis. You know, people are looking at that. How can I be able to leverage those assets in other places that give me a competitive advantage to my business and what I'm doing? And I love what you said about, it's not about, you know, winning. It's about how can I be able to grow my business and not have so much pain that now I'm, you know, stuck here in one spot, the United States, and I've only got these resources. Now the world is at your doorstep. And when there are moves with tariffs, you know, all those things are going to happen. But you can pivot and go anywhere because you can get connected and talk to anyone across the world at the touch. You know, we've all got these sitting on your table right now, these cell phones, and we can reach out and touch anyone in the world. I mean, how amazing is that?
Yeah. When I worked internationally as a media and communications officer, policy advisor, I had two sat phones and three GSM mobile phones with nine SIM cards. And depending on whether I was in Egypt or Sudan or London or wherever, I would be switching those all out. And it's now all WhatsApp, for better or for worse. But it's different, and it's certainly accelerated the rate at which we can communicate. There are other issues that emerge in as we shift everything to apps owned by private companies. But in any case, it's fascinating to me. Mel, I said we would circle back and talk about, specifically about the USMCA, the US-Mexico agreement, something that has been signed by the heads of state, has not been ratified. Congress is preoccupied with other important issues. What are your thoughts on the USMCA? What do people need to know about it? Top line kind of messaging. Why is this important to kind of get this new agreement ratified?
I think I'll start answering it by saying that absolutely what you just said about the internet and all of the changes affiliated with that, which are coming down the road, is exactly the reason why we need the USMCA passed. Because NAFTA was great for 20 years, but the whole world changed in 20 years. When we negotiated NAFTA, we didn't have the internet as we do now. We didn't have that pervasiveness. We didn't have the ease of, as you mentioned earlier, Adrian, the single person sitting at home who's selling their product to in Vietnam.
Yeah. Unless you were at a university, you didn't have an email address. America Online was still sending out CDs in the mail to try to get people onto this new thing. So the game has changed.
Exactly. And so the time was right to bring that trade agreement up to the modern day, because the whole purpose of that trade agreement, as I mentioned earlier, is to underpin that activity, that two-way activity of exporting and attracting investment. Well, if you're ignoring several large industries, pharmaceuticals would be another good example, because that pharmaceutical industry really ballooned out in 20 years and hadn't really been addressed. So those are the reasons why it's essential to get this deal done, because it's a trade deal for the world we live in. And it has elements in it of flexibility, which can also make it the trade deal for the future world that we're going to be living in. Now, there's some concerns about it, which has contributed to the blockade in Congress. And kudos to particularly Representative Stanton, who came out early and publicly in support long before there was any indication from party leadership that they were even interested in this. So I have to give him a shout out. There are some objections still in actually two key areas, labor and pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals is, in a sense, easier. It goes to the length of patent protection time. The current deal calls for 10 years. The industry prefers a longer span. But unfortunately for our industry, neither Mexico nor Canada prefers a longer span. So that's one ball that's still in the air. The other one is a concern from the labor side on two things. Workers' rights and protection for those workers' rights, and salary. Salary is addressed very specifically in some ways. You take the automotive industry, for instance, on the provisions of the USMCA dealing with automotives. It specifies that the parts must be produced by workers earning a minimum of $16 per hour. Now, you know, you could argue that that's designed to force everything to be produced in the US, but that's not actually the intention. The intention is to bring wages up in Mexico, raise the standard of living for human beings on both sides of the border, minimize pain, right? So that's a good thing. But there's a lot of skepticism, even though Mexico has already passed revisions to its domestic labor law. They did that almost immediately. But even though they have a new law in place, even though they are moving right now to provide additional measures of protection, and even though the Mexican president is what we political scientist types would call, a populist president, a man of the people, and therefore more likely to favor workers' rights over corporate rights, despite that whole dynamic, some level of skepticism remains. and therefore there's been reluctance to move ahead. I would say that the latest indications from Speaker Pelosi are that this is not going to get dealt with this year. If that proves to be true, that is extremely unfortunate. Because as we all know, once we get into next year, we're going to be in campaign mode. And I think that being in campaign mode and given the acrimonious political environment of our country, I fear that the trade agreement then becomes a case of, well, why would we want to give Trump a win? And my answer to that is, this isn't about the Republicans win and the Democrats lose, or vice versa. It's about what is good for this country. And this deal is good for this country. This deal matters for human beings, for Americans. So let's quit playing around as if this is some rhetorical political question in the sky. This is about on-the-ground business, on-the-ground jobs, on-the-ground investment. Let's try to get it done.
Very passionately and well said. Kevin?
I had one point. The other risk is if we don't get this done, we fall behind. Other countries are executing trade agreements. We're falling behind. So as a region, now I say region, North American region, if we don't get this thing done, we now are at risk of not being able to capitalize on, you brought up a very good point, wages going up across the board. Think of the buying power that those citizens will have now, right? Whether it's buying product from us or from Mexico or Canada or from Europe or Asia, South America, they now are moved up into the world. They can go out and get the Apple Watch, the whatever products we make that they're going to be interested in. So I fear we fall behind as a region if we don't move forward. I recognize the political difficulties that are there, but my gosh, as you said, it's time to put the politics aside. This benefits us as a people and as a region.
And Mel, last time you were on this show back in July, we talked about China in Africa and how they outspent us, they outmaneuvered us, they were willing to play a long game and to start it much sooner than us. And whereas many African countries, 11 of the fastest growing economies on the planet are in Africa, many of them would rather be doing business with the United States unless we're not there when they need it, and unless we're not on the ground negotiating, providing services. Because every, you know, as much as you might have a concern about some of these issues, maybe you don't, I might, like pipelines, for example, when you're having a project that's going to have that level of involvement in the local community, sometimes good things happen too. Sometimes schools get built and people get clean water and other things. So while there are downside risks of all of those, and we should look very carefully at the environmental and human costs of extractive industries, at the same time, we also got to look at the reality of that these can be a force for good. And this us versus them rhetoric doesn't serve us. Here at Business Radio X, we say some media leans left, some media leans right, we lean business. And in this studio, we lean human. So let's talk about the ways in which we can all do better together. One thing we didn't talk about, which we need to, I was about to shut this down, and I realized we can't, because the one thing that's brought us all together is, in fact, the Global Chamber. Doug Brunke brought you here, sent you to me, and we've done a whole series with them. I'd love just to hear very briefly from each of you about the Global Chamber. They have an event coming up, which I'll speak to at the very end, but this is one of several very active international organizations here in the Valley. I'd love to hear from you what your thoughts are on the Global Chamber as an opportunity for folks that aren't as familiar with it. Mel?
Let me see. In 1 minute or less, I've known Doug now for many years, and he is a consummate professional and a consummate connector. And he has managed to build an organizational structure which is focused on personal relationships, as Kevin mentioned earlier, which is focused on business interconnectivity, as you guys have mentioned earlier. And he basically built that from a very small base to now over 500 and I think 35 countries. So if that's not a resource that you think you need to know about, I think you're crazy.
Right. Great. And yeah, Jeffrey, you mentioned the Global Chamber and how important your membership has been. For somebody who's not a member, is not aware of them, what would you say to kind of pique their interest and get them to check out the website, come to the events, things like that?
I would just say that the Global Chamber, and Doug refers to it as the Global Tribe, is truly that. It's really not just an organization. It's truly a connected network of people that want to sincerely interact and facilitate meeting whatever your needs are. And Doug's done it in such an authentic way, to your point, Mel, that I think that it's just created this incredible spider effect of going global and connecting so quickly. I mean, he's only had this thing going for a few years, but when you look at how far he's gone, I mean, when we first came on board, we were able to connect with people all the way down in Buenos Aires, Argentina, that were global chamber members. I mean, so I would tell you, if you truly want to impact your business and you truly want to get connected and grow in other markets, the Global Chamber, to me, I don't think there's any better organization that has actual people that want to conduct business. They're not selling memberships. They're truly creating a tribe of individuals that want to come together and be a team of networkers. And Doug owes me for that one.
Kevin, you're on the advisory board. You've served in a number of different capacities with many internationally minded organizations. What does the Global Chamber mean to you? What do folks need to know about it?
Right, a couple of things. Well, maybe to echo Jeffrey's comments, I always look back, especially this time of year, and say, how did I source my new business opportunities? How did I source new relationships? And roughly a little over 50% of my new relationships have had some kind of connectivity to the Global Chamber, whether it was somebody I met at a Global Chamber event, whether it's somebody that Doug introduced me to, because as Mel said, he is a great connector. He's amazing at what he does. Or it's somebody I met at a function who introduced me to somebody else, who introduced me to somebody else, and then you get connected that way. So it's a great resource for globally minded individuals. And even if you're thinking about going global, you're not there yet. It's a great way to connect and learn. And that's the other benefit. It's not just, you know, business centering there. It's knowledge. As Mel said, he's in, 525 metros, a couple hundred different countries. Don't quote me on the numbers there, but
it sounds right to me.
Yeah. I have to look at the website. But if you're thinking about doing something in Madrid or London or whatever, there's global chambers in these major metropolitan areas that have active memberships. You can pick up the phone. You can get on the internet. You can communicate with members in these other chapters and start getting, you know, some of your questions answered, or start having a dialogue about what you're thinking about and what maybe some of your concerns are, and get some really good feedback from some very, very knowledgeable folks in those markets. So to me, it's the knowledge that really comes out of those connections. And yeah, the business side tends to follow that.
Absolutely. I mean, I
just want to insert on that. I think you were going there, but to complete that, there's actually workshops that you can join that are based on increasing your knowledge on how to facilitate business globally. So not just, you know, business connections, but actual workshops that you can attend. And I think that that's another key webinars component that you brought up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spent the middle 15 years of my life as an expat. And one thing that I think a lot of people who don't have extensive international experience themselves is how welcoming so many communities are, whether it's communities of faith or business or the nonprofit world or whatever. So something like this should not be intimidating. The Global Chamber is a way of bringing that warmth and that human connection and making it available wherever you are. There is a network of people that will be excited to meet you, to learn more about you, to introduce you to others. And it's really an extraordinary phenomenon that is building momentum as we grow together. And of course, there is a summit coming up on December 10. The summit is Global to Local, Growing Sustainably. It's brought to you by the Global Chamber. It's going to be at ASU Skysong. All the details are available at globalchamber.org. We'll also link to them here in the description below this show. I'm looking forward to being there. It's going to be an incredible mix of folks representing large organizations, small businesses, politicians, nonprofits. And it really will be a place, if you're an experienced global citizen or whether you're global curious, this should definitely be a place that you come. You can pick up a ticket. You can participate in the networking. There's going to be informational sessions and stuff. Look forward to meeting many of you there and building our network together. Again, thank you so much to our guests, Melissa Sanderson, Jeffrey Garza Walker, Joshua Rodriguez, and Kevin Hull. Thank you for joining us today. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre. We'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.